The study in the Gospel of Luke is one that we could spend a lot of time on. And this past week, I kind of paused a little bit to give some consideration to the amount of time that I wanted to devote to this study, and realized that if I continue at my current pace, that I may not live long enough to finish it. And so I decided that we're probably going to start taking larger portions of text as we move forward, especially as some of these portions become somewhat repetitious. Today is a perfect example of that, where we have repetition in the stories. Now, could we take each story and build a message out of that and focus on a different theme and those kinds of things? Certainly you could. To do that, though, would require at least 2 years of study, 2 years of messages. And I'm not willing to devote that amount of time to this. And so I just don't feel that that's where we need to go, and that's the direction that I'm being led in that regard. So we're going to move this forward a little more rapidly. Now, what will that mean for you? Well, it will mean that you're going to have larger portions of text to try to consume. And what I'm going to encourage you to do is always spend some time, either before or after — you're always going to know what we're studying — sometime before or after, doing some study on your own so that you can glean additional information from some of these passages that I may leave out or that I may overlook in the process of moving through this. It also means you have to listen fast. And so you have to stay focused and sharp as we go through this, because otherwise it becomes a blur, and I don't want that either. So we're going to try to find some balance in all of this, but we're going to take a little larger section of text as we go through. Today we are in chapter 8, in Luke chapter 8, in verses 22 all the way through verse 56, which carries us to the end of the chapter. What we see in this are several stories, four to be specific, of where Jesus interacts miraculously with people in a variety of ways. And what we see are the distinctives that are revealed in the way that Jesus relates to them. In other words, a need arises. In each situation, we see a need very clearly displayed. Jesus responds miraculously to meet this need. And he responds to each one differently and uniquely based on their need. But here's where the really interesting part comes in for me, is not so much that, because I already believe that Jesus is the creator of all things. I already believe he's the Son of God. I believe that everything that exists came into existence because of him. And I believe that everything that exists holds together and remains in existence because of him. And so I already believe that. I need no persuasion or convincing regarding the deity, authority, and power of Christ. But what I do find very interesting is the response of the people who experience and who observe his work. And there we find very different responses. And so the title of the message today is given to us in order to help understand that there is a contrast of belief. Wherever Christ does a miraculous work, wherever God breaks in to human history and does something that is uniquely him, wherever God is at work in those subtle ways that we take for granted and we assume are a part of a natural process, but forget that he created the nature that made it possible, in all of those things, people respond differently. Some look at the beauty of a day and give God the praise and the glory, as George did in his prayer. And some look at it and say, gosh, I hope it doesn't get hot. There is such a different way that we respond to the circumstances, to the things that we see. Forget all of that other stuff and just think about your response to God. Do you respond to God with love and grace as he has given to you? Do you respond to God with openness and acceptance? Do you respond to God with humility and surrender? Do you respond to God with praise and worship and awe? Or do you respond with skepticism, doubt, fear? What is it that is driving your heart today? What is it that is moving you? You will always be, and sometimes within just the single person, there will be that contrast of belief. Look at the first of the stories that we take up today in chapter 8, verse 22. It says, one day he got into a boat with his disciples and said to them, let us go across to the other side of the lake. So they set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep, and a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in danger. They went and woke him, saying, Master, Master, we are perishing. And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased, and there was a calm. And he said to them, where is your faith? And they were afraid, and they marveled, saying to one another, who then is this that he commands even winds and water, and they obey him? The first thing that we see is the power of Christ over the destruction that would otherwise come as a result of these natural forces. God has power over the things that seek to destroy us, whether it is a natural phenomenon that he created and has set in motion, or whether it's something other than that that would ultimately lead to our destruction. Think of it not so much in terms of having a physical existence, but having the fear of being utterly destroyed. All of that stands in sharp relief against the reality that God has made us eternal, and that through his redeeming work in Jesus Christ has secured us for all eternity. The story of the storm and the disciples in the boat, though, shows us that their need was something that came upon them suddenly. It says that the storm, they got in the boat, they went across the lake, and all of a sudden the storm blows in. We all know how the storms of life come to us without warning, and they come to us almost, it seems, with the suddenness that threatens us. It is the threat of the storm that all of us deal with at various times in our lives. They go to Jesus. You have to give them credit. They went to Jesus. Was it because they were desperate and they didn't know what else to do? Absolutely. Make no mistake about it. That is exactly why they went to him. They went to him out of desperation. They went to him out of fear. But I want you to think about the disciples right now, and think of it in terms of your own experience, and you'll see how this easily fits into our understanding. At the moment they went to Jesus, was their focus and attention on him or on the storm? Listen again to what they said. It says, they woke him saying, we are perishing, we are perishing. Their focus was on the storm. They were dying and they were drowning, and they knew that the boat was about to be swamped. And they were so consumed with what was right in front of them that while, yes, they cried out to Jesus, even in their outcry, they still had their full attention on the storm. The question that comes in a moment when Jesus says, where is your faith, is a question designed to draw them back to the reality that their faith wasn't on Jesus. Their faith was on the reality that the storm was more powerful than they were, and it was about to destroy them. Where's their faith today? Jesus awoke. He commanded the sea. He commanded the wind. And there was calm. The need that they have or had was the result of the threat of the storm. The miracle was that Jesus commanded the storm to cease, and in doing so demonstrated his power over nature. The Creator commanded the creation, and it obeyed. How could it do otherwise? The Commander commanded, the Creator commanded the creation. Cease. There was calm. There was peace. They were saved. And then he said, where is your faith? The people that heard him, the disciples, lacked faith that Jesus could save and sustain them. They had already learned to believe that he could heal. They had already learned to believe that he could cast out demons. They had already learned to believe that he had the ability to understand things that went well beyond theirs. But they didn't believe that he had the power over nature. So that when he calmed the sea and when he quieted the wind, they exclaimed, who then is this that he commands even winds and water? What are the limits of Jesus' power in your life? I'm more than happy for Jesus to do spiritual things, aren't you? I'm more than willing for Jesus to do what some would call religious things. I'm more than happy for Jesus to move us from within. I'm even more than happy for him to do things that go beyond what I can imagine or see. But when it gets out there a little ways, I have to confess to you that I don't pause to consider his power in the midst of that. Does Jesus still work in the way that he did then? I believe that he does. With some differences and variations, and we have seen that through the ages, and I think we see it even in the days of Jesus. He did some things in a certain way in some places and other things in a different way in other places. We see the disciples who became the apostles did some amazing and miraculous things, especially early on in the work that they did. And then things changed somewhat, and yet the name continued to be declared that they had set out to proclaim all along, so that the gospel remained the focus of attention, but the application changed and has done so over the course of the ages. The gospel remains the same. Jesus remains the same. And all of the things that God does, he does in order to draw our attention back to the authority and power of Christ. But I have to admit that I'm really more accustomed to Jesus working within the boundaries of what I expect. And sometimes I find myself sitting in the boat on a calm sea and thinking, my goodness, he even commands the winds and the waves. Don't forget who's in charge of it all. The power of Christ then extends over the things that otherwise would destroy us. That is true of natural phenomena. It is true of anything that poses a threat, so that when we read in the Bible in response to what we see here, we discover that there is nothing that is able to separate us from the love of God, so that in Christ we are indeed more than conquerors. The power of Christ over destruction leads us then also to the second story, which shows the power of Christ over demons. In verse 26, perhaps the most famous dealing that Jesus had with the demonic is in this story. They sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when Jesus had stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house, but among the tombs. And when he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it had seized him, and he was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles. But he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these. So he gave them permission, and then the demons came out of the man, entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and he returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. We see the power of Christ over demons, and when we look at it, we see again the same pattern. The need presents immediately as he steps onto the shore. The man with the demons comes up to him and acknowledges him. The demons acknowledge Jesus and recognize him as the Son of the Most High God. They fear him, knowing that he has the power to torment them, meaning to cast them into the abyss, or hell is what it is talking about. And they thought that maybe that's what Jesus was going to do. There is a day coming when Jesus will indeed do that, but that day has not yet arrived. And so they cried out to him in fear and acknowledgement. So we see, first of all, the response of the demons to Jesus is one of surrender, submission, and fear. If the demonic forces that exist in and around this world are subject to the power of Christ, how is it that you and I would stand against it? When it stands to reason that these are things that are being told, not as some sort of supernatural flavoring for the story of the gospel, but as the reality of life on planet Earth, as we live recognizing that we indeed have a very real enemy. The dangerous part of dealing with the demonic is that we underestimate the demons. And there are those among us and those in this world within the Christian community that have tried to encourage us to believe that the demonic simply doesn't exist. It is nothing more than an expression of some form of mental illness or something of that nature. I admit that it is difficult at times to tell the difference. But for me to ever come to a place to say that the demonic does not exist is to be aligned with those I believe to be fools. I'm not saying that I won't be foolish at times, but I'm saying I do not wish to be a fool. To ignore the power of evil is to do so at our own peril. It is to do so at the denial of the truth of the Word of God. It is to do so in the face of the overwhelming power of our Savior. At the same time, an equal danger exists with regard to how we deal with the demonic, and that is to give it too much attention. The point of the story is not the demons, even though they represent legion, which could be a representative of a Roman number that was assigned to a commander. A legion would have been 6,000. Were there 6,000 demons? I don't know. It's likely that there were thousands that came out, because there were probably thousands of pigs in the herd that drowned. The point, though, isn't the demonic. It didn't matter which one or how many. The power exerted by Jesus is the same. Jesus did not have to command them with greater authority or with more effort. He did the same as he had always done. He simply spoke and it happened. The power of Christ is something that always extends over everything, that includes the demonic. And when we elevate the demonic to some form of spiritual authority that exists beyond that of Christ, we have put ourselves in a dangerous position that is equally foolish. So that the danger in dealing with the demonic is to underestimate demons or to overestimate. The way we do either or is by focusing the attention on the demonic. The point of the story isn't the demonic. The point of the story is the power of Jesus. Jesus commanded them and was about to cast them out. They cried out. Rather than being cast into the abyss, they asked to go into the pigs. He gave them permission. They did so. The pigs rushed down the side of the bank and into the water, and there they drowned. There are all kinds of theories and ideas and thoughts about what this means and what it represents. I don't have anything for you because I don't know. I don't know why the pigs responded the way they did. I don't know why he chose them. Was it because the Jews weren't supposed to have pigs in the first place? I don't know. I just know there was a lot of floating bacon all of a sudden. That's what I know. And I know if I had been there, there would have been a fire pit someplace. What is the point? The point isn't anything other than the authority of Christ over the demonic. That's the point. The demons left the man and they left that place. And they did so at the command of Jesus. What are the demons that you are dealing with today? What are the demons that are at work in and around us today? For you to think that there aren't any would be foolish indeed. For us to realize that they are there, but to give them more authority or to arrange our lives around the demonic is equally wrong. We must stand firmly and squarely in the reality of our own submission to Christ, recognizing that the only authority or power that we have in any spiritual manner over such things comes not from us, but from Him. Always from Him. We belong to Jesus. We are kept by Jesus. The need that the man had was deliverance from demons. The miracle was that the demons were cast out of him. But the response is seen in the man and in the people of the community. The people of the community came back and they asked Jesus to leave. They were too afraid of what they had seen. I wonder how many times we've pushed Jesus away because the things that he has done have unnerved, unsettled, or frightened us. I wonder how many times we push Jesus away because we don't know how to process what he has done within the confines of the boundaries we've established. I wonder how many times we've pushed him away and his presence, his authority, his power, and his work has been moved out of the area where we live because we would rather be comfortable, convenient, and satisfied with something that we know and we control than be in the place where we must walk by faith, not by sight. I wonder. The message for us all is that Christ has power over all things, that includes the most powerful evil forces, and that is true today. It will be true tomorrow, and it will be true when Jesus comes back and they are defeated once and for all. Don't push Jesus away just because what he does frightens you. Don't push Jesus away just because what he does is something you don't understand. Don't push Jesus away in an effort to try to arrange your life so that it fits within the expectations of others or even your own comfort zone. The power of Christ over destruction and the power of Christ over demons is clear. Thirdly, we see the power of Christ over disease. This next story is actually two stories in one. So we'll start the story and then we'll come back and we'll see it from a different light. Let me skip a couple of verses. The power of Christ over disease in verse 43. It says, there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and though she had spent all her living on physicians, she could not be healed by anyone. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his garment, and immediately her discharge of blood ceased. And Jesus said, who was it that touched me? When all denied it, Peter said, Master, the crowd surrounds you and are pressing in on you. But Jesus said, someone touched me, for I perceive that power has gone out from me. And when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him, declared in the presence of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been immediately healed. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. We see the power of Christ over disease. The need is clear. It is physical healing from this disease that she has been plagued with for over 12 years. Everything that she had has gone into hiring people that had various suggestions and ministrations on how to help her. But the problem is none of it worked. She is still dealing with the disease. Now, this disease that she has is described as an issue of blood. And while I realize it is not something that is comfortable for us to discuss, you need to understand the implications of this. In a Jewish society and culture, because of what she was experiencing, she was considered ceremonially unclean and therefore was an outcast from her family, her community, and her faith community. She was not allowed to go into the temple. She was not allowed to worship. She was not allowed to even be touched by another person who was willing to or who was going to go into a place for worship. This was a big deal. This woman is suffering in a way that is beyond what we see just because of her physical issues. She is suffering in a way that has to do with isolation, it has to do with fear, and it has to do with condemnation. It's almost like she was a leper in that community and in that day and age. But somehow she worms her way into the crowd that is pressing in on Jesus, believing that if she can just touch the clothing that he wears, that she will be healed. It shows us that her response was one that recognized that Jesus had the power to heal her, even though she did not have his attention at the moment. She just wanted to be close to Jesus. Think about that in contrast to the belief of those who saw Jesus cast out the demons. They pushed him away. She pushed in to get to him and to get close. She touched the hem of his garment, and as soon as she did, she was healed. Was it because his clothes were glowing and radiant and had power emanating from them? Nobody else was being affected by them. It didn't have anything to do with his garment. It had to do with him. And it didn't have anything to do with her believing that the garment had power. It had to do with her believing that Jesus had power. She was healed because of her faith in Christ. Jesus perceived that this had happened and that power had gone out from him. And when he stopped and he asked, "Somebody touched me." And they said, "Are you out of your mind? Everybody's touching you." He said, "No, this is different." And notice what she does. When she realizes she is found out, she falls at his feet in humble and surrendered submission. And she cries out and confesses what she has done. And she does so, it says very specifically, in front of everybody. So that it becomes a testimony of her faith. Jesus says, "Your faith has healed you. Go in peace." It is a beautiful expression, and it is a beautiful extension of grace. It is so intimate and personal that it's really hard to even put yourself in the crowd. But when you do, you can imagine that when this woman cried out to Jesus, fell down before him, all of the noise stopped. Everybody watched. Rather than us pushing Jesus away, rather than us wondering about whether or not he has what it takes to get us through to the other side, rather than us doing all of those things, what would it be like if we were living our lives driven by the brokenness of our hearts, clamoring just to be close to Christ? I promise you, the closer you come, the more you will sense and know the power that flows only from him. In the midst of this overwhelming story, Jesus was already on his way to something else. The verses that I skipped in verses 40 and 41 give us an introduction. When Jesus returned, the crowd welcomed him, for they were all waiting for him. And there came a man named Jairus, who was a ruler of the synagogue, and falling at Jesus' feet, he implored him to come to his house. He had an only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she was dying. It was in the midst of Jesus going with Jairus that the woman touches his garment, and he stops in order to address that issue. But then we see in verse 49... while he was still speaking, that is to the crowd surrounding the woman that had been healed, someone from the ruler's house came and said, "Your daughter is dead. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." The disciples didn't think Jesus had power over the storm, and the followers didn't believe Jesus had power over death. But Jesus, on hearing this, answered him, "Do not fear, only believe. She will be well." When he came to the house, he allowed no one to enter with him except Peter, John, James, and the father and mother of the child. And all were weeping and mourning for her. But he said, "Do not weep. She is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him, knowing that she was dead. But taking her by the hand, he called, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up at once. He directed that something should be given her to eat, and her parents were amazed, but he charged them to tell no one what had happened. The fourth story shows us the power of Christ over death. Jesus has the power over destruction. He has the power over demons. He has the power over disease. And he has the power over death. He has the power over natural forces. He has the power over spiritual forces. He has the power over physical forces. And he has the power over eternal forces. We see all of this being displayed for us, and all of the stories, while unique, individual, and having variation of their own, all of them point in the same direction, ultimately back to Jesus. Jesus displays his power over death. The need is clear. A 12-year-old girl has died. The miracle, Jesus takes her by the hand, her spirit returns to her body, and she rises from the dead. The response as Jesus went into the house by some was to laugh at him. The response by others was to no longer trouble him, believing that death was the end. How many times do we live with the reality that death seems to be the end? But how many times does Scripture remind us death is never the end for the believer? I sat Tuesday afternoon with Harry. He'd slept all day, Mona said. Wouldn't wake up for anything. She went over and shook him and said, "Harry, wake up. Someone's here to see you." And he fluttered his eyes, and I spoke to him and I said, "Harry, it's Scott. I said, I came to visit with you. You able to wake up?" He said, "I can hear you. I can't see you." And I said, "Well, give it a minute and let it clear up." And he got his eyes open and got them cleared away. And big smile came on his face, and we talked for a little bit. And he took my hand, and he wouldn't let go of it. And I was leaning over, and I was holding his hand, and he was just gripping harder and harder. And finally, that posture got uncomfortable, and I grabbed a chair and pulled it over, and I just held on to his hand, and we sat. And for an hour, we talked. We talked about everything. We talked about churches where we've been, about people that we have in common. We talked about you and about the 20 years that they spent as a part of this church family. And we talked about their family and his 5 kids and his 15 grandkids and his 15 great-grandkids and his 1 great-great-grandkid. Yes, I was paying attention. I don't know their names. That's too much. Don't ask me that. And we had a wonderful conversation and a wonderful visit. We both knew intuitively it was probably the last one we would have this side of heaven. So I prayed for him, and when I did, he looked at me with tears in his eyes and with that smile, that kind of that grin that he always seems to have on his face. He just shook his head. I knew that I wouldn't hold his hand again. Not like that. But we both felt the abiding peace of knowing this is not the end. Death does not overcome the one who believes in the one who has the power over death. I'm not telling you that there isn't grief and loss, and I'm not telling or suggesting for a moment that it isn't painful and hard. I'm not saying any of that. I am saying in the midst of that is hope. In the midst of that is peace. Jesus raised her from the dead. Why did he tell them not to say anything? I think Jesus was content to let the unbelievers who laughed at him in the first place go on thinking that she was just asleep, or that they had misdiagnosed her and she wasn't actually dead, because they didn't believe anyway. And I think he probably did it because she was a 12-year-old child, and he didn't want her to become the object of morbid curiosity and weirdness on the part of people who wouldn't understand. I don't really know, and it doesn't say. I just know what he did say. but it takes nothing away from the power of what he did. Some laughed that Jesus thought he could bring her back to life. The parents were amazed and grateful. Jesus instructed them to tell no one because he wanted to protect them all. But in the midst of all of that, we have the Spirit guiding Luke to record for us this story so that we can be reminded in those moments of overwhelming grief, we can be reminded that Jesus has the power over death. So what is this all about? The power of Christ is displayed over that which would destroy us. His power is displayed over the demons that would annoy us. His power is displayed over the disease that would limit us, and power over death that would separate us. That tells me that I want to trust the one with the power. People in this world and in this life jockey for power and position all the time and hold on to it, but for a brief moment. Jesus never loses it. What is this all about? It is about the contrast of belief. But the question is, all the power in the world displayed through Christ and given to us as the evidence of his authority in passages like this and time after time after time is still going to be meaningless if we stand back and we push Jesus away because we're afraid, or we laugh and scoff at his ability to do something, or that we focus so much attention on what would otherwise destroy us that we forget about his power, or we fail to surrender and humbly believe, or we do not listen and be grateful when he responds. The real issue here is Jesus, but beyond that is, what do you believe? Who do you identify with most? The Gerasenes? The man that was healed and delivered? Those are the kinds of things that we have to answer, and that is the real question for our lives today. What do we believe? The contrast of belief will always be present with us wherever the gospel is proclaimed. Be sure that when you choose to listen to the truth. There isn't anything that Jesus can't do, and there isn't anything that he hasn't already done. Trust me.